Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Good, bad, crazy martinis for you as usual, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, we start with a very unique day in American history. President Obama will admit that something his administration was in charge of didn't work right. Now, we haven't heard the announcement yet. I'm sure it's not his fault personally. There's no way that could be possible. Whether or not anybody's head will metaphorically roll, we don't know. I'm sure he'll blame it on the shutdown somehow. The fact that he's admitted that this rollout has been a disaster and will at least tacitly acknowledge the fact that it's got to get fixed or else this whole thing's going to crumble before it even gets started for him, that's got to be at least one major step in the right direction.
You know, let me observe, Greg, that Obamacare does cover beheadings. So head can't roll. That will be covered as long as you can log through the site, and then it'll be much more successful. No, I mean, look, we're looking forward to this event. But we all kind of can predict some of the things that are going to happen, which include we've come too far to turn back now. Partisan politics has played games with this. And, you know, there are many Americans who've managed to get through, and all of them are on the stage behind me right now, you know, that kind of stuff. They're left in a very awkward position here. And Time magazine was saying that, oh, Obama's got to get mad over this. Who's he going to get mad at? I suppose Sibelius. And the joke was at this point, he'll be announced that the program is being renamed Sibelius Care.
That's right.
Instead of Obamacare. So his name isn't on it anymore. But I was really struck by a comment Sibelius made this. It was made earlier, quoted this weekend in the Wall Street Journal, saying that after 2 weeks of review, the Health and Human Services Secretary concluded we didn't have enough testing specifically for high volumes for a very complicated project. The online insurance marketplace needed 5 years of construction and a year of testing, she said. We had 2 years and almost no testing. I'm sure she's kind of thinking this, look, it was a really big project and I just didn't have enough time to do it. Well, whose fault is that, ma'am? It's either your fault for not telling the president you needed 4 more years, no pun intended, to finish this project, or it's his fault for telling you to do something that required 6 years and, you know, you giving you only 2 years to do it. Or thirdly, Greg, how long did the moonshot project go?
Kennedy said it in 61. It took 8 years to get there.
Okay, 8 years. You know, I mean, we did manage to take down Nazi Germany in less time. Basically, we're building a very big website, which got to handle a lot of data. I'm not saying that's an easy task. All I'm saying is that usually you can do it in less than 6 years. Either she's vastly overestimating the amount of time that's necessary, and she's lying now, possibility. We know she was lying during all of her previous happy talk comments running into this. Or alternately, there were some folks within the administration who knew this was a disaster. And now the question is, who knew and who, you know, who ignored these people? Or was the entire administration completely blindsided by this? Because if they're completely blindsided by this, they shouldn't be entrusted with Nerf tools, never mind actual, you know, control over 1/6 of the nation's economy. There is no innocent mistake option here. There's no way, you know, nobody could afford. No, you can't say, well, really, we needed 6 years instead of the 2 years we said it was going to take. That's not a rounding error. That's not a little bit off. That's completely off. We will see whether she gets thrown under the bus. National Review is sponsoring a petition to have Sibelius fired. I vehemently disagree with this. I want to keep her where she can do the most damage. 4 more years for Kathleen Sibelius, I would say. But here's the thing. The intriguing thing that you're now starting to see in some of the coverage is the recognition that, oh, this wasn't just high traffic. This wasn't just this line of code's got to get fixed or something like that. This is a website that is fundamentally unsuited for the task it has been assigned. There's no easy way to fix it without months and weeks and months of work on it. And, oh, by the way, the deadline for purchasing health insurance is approaching closer every day.
One of the other things I just find fascinating, this particular tweet came from Mark Murray over at NBC, but others have done it too. And he says, well, clearly there's been problems with the exchanges, and so that's a problem for Obama. But what will the GOP do once the exchanges and the websites are fixed? And I think the conservative response is, well, then we'll get to the sticker shock. Then we'll get to the huge deductibles. Then we'll get to lost jobs. It's only going to get worse.
I mean, this is a double-edged sword for the administration. The first thing is that, you know, running a website, most people buy from Amazon all the time. They download music from iTunes. People are used to websites working, and they don't think of it as hard, even if it is actually technically pretty hard. So this makes them look kind of silly and incompetent. The good news for the administration is the impression this is just a website problem. You know, you got to call Nick Burns, your company computer guy, a guy with like 14 pagers and BlackBerries and devices on his belt, who will sigh and roll his eyes at how silly and stupid you are. He'll tweak something in the back and the thing will get taken care of. And that's probably not what's going to happen here. It's going to take much longer than that. But even once you get the website working perfectly fine, you're going to end up with a whole bunch of people saying, oh my goodness, these prices are extremely high. And in a post, a kind of sneak preview for folks on coming on Campaign Spot, for just about everybody who's uninsured, paying the fine and not getting on insurance will be the less expensive option. This doesn't mean they're going to do it. They'll all, you know, take that option. But if your number one thing is, look, I just can't afford it, I just have no money in my disposable income to pay for health insurance, then the fine is going to be the option. And we're not actually going to reduce the number of uninsured at all. Or we'll have much lesser reductions in the number of uninsured than the administration predicted, which, oh, by the way, was the whole point of why we're doing all this messing around with the, as I said, 1/6 of the nation's economy.
And let's talk now in our second martini about why young people in America might not be in a position to buy really expensive health care insurance. According to a study released today by some outfit called the Opportunity Nation Coalition, almost 6 million young people are neither in school nor working. We're talking 15% of young people aged 16 to 24, not in school of any kind, not working. That's, again, 1/6. Amazing how these fractions keep repeating themselves. Anyway, the coalition also finds that 49 states have seen an increase in the number of families living in poverty, and 45 states have seen household median incomes fall in the last year. So, Jim, we'll probably get, I think, a new jobs report sometime this week because it was delayed by the shutdown, but the numbers all around, whether it's a government report or a private sector report, just show American families struggling more and more and more. And if the young generation keeps going with numbers like this, it's just going to be cataclysmic.
Yeah, the report you pointed me to is really depressing because, as they said, you know, a whole bunch of the nation's largest cities, Chicago, Houston, Dallas, Miami, Philadelphia, New York, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and Riverside, California, all have more than 100,000 idle youth. These are folks who are not in school or working between the ages of 16 and 24. And that's awful. And what's kind of intriguing is I have two thoughts and reactions. The first is that they say that, you know, look, all these people need jobs. That's a fairly big deal. And so they have this program which tries to teach computer programming or equipment repair or things to help them get a job. But it says it also includes life coaching so they can learn skills such as time management. This is a really stinging indictment of our, what I'm assuming is our public school system. I'm assuming that of those, you know, 6 million people, probably not too many of them went to, you know, big, fancy, expensive private schools. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe some of them are in there. But, you know, you figure most of them are public school graduates, and except the folks who are under 16 and, you know, 16 to 18 who probably just dropped out of high school. And they have, as they're saying, you know, basic life skills of show up when your boss tells you to. Work your entire shift. These are, you know, fairly basic requirements of being able to get a job and keep a job. And it sounds like they're not so up to speed on this. So I'm looking at this on the one part. This is a real indictment of the schools. And the second point, I'm looking at it thinking, like, a lot of us are blessed with two parents that love us and try to take care of us and will occasionally whoop our behind when we don't do what we're supposed to do. I really feel really bad because you're assuming that for of these 6 million, a lot of them don't have any type of they refer to social capital. Basically what it means is, you know, peers that are doing the same, meaning going to work and you know, going to school and doing all this. And then this next thing is people around them who will say, hey, you got to go get a job. Hey, did you look for a job today? You know, people who will both encourage them and also maybe push them a little bit to go out and become productive members of society. I think it was really, you know, a great quote in the story. It says a lot of times we don't look at the data because we don't want to be depressed. This is the president of Des Moines Area Community College. Doesn't that kind of sum up the economy for the past 5 years, Greg?
Pretty much.
One of the ways this country is dealing with the continuing, you know, you might say a 5-year economic recession or the Great Recession, whatever you want to call it, is just by not thinking about it so much. And, well, you can see where it's gotten us so far.
All three martinis really flow well into one another today. Out to Portland, Oregon we go. This is courtesy of Breitbart.com. I'm going to quote pretty liberally from this piece. Dr. Veronese Gutierrez is a principal with Oregon's Portland Public Schools. And she's convinced that America's white culture negatively influences educators' worldview and the manner in which they teach their students, and therefore there's a major black-white achievement gap that exists throughout the public education system. Case in point, last year a teacher in the district presented a lesson that included a reference to peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and Gutierrez says that by using sandwiches as an illustration, the teacher was engaged in a very subtle form of racism. What about Somali or Hispanic students who might not eat sandwiches? Another way would be to say it, Americans eat peanut butter and jelly. Do you have anything like that? Let them tell you. Maybe they eat torta or they eat pita. So now the district has spent $526,000 and change to provide extensive staff meetings, classroom observations, and other initiatives, all based through this Pacific educational group. Here's examples of what they're learning. In addition to teaching that peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are racist, PEG trains educators to view rugged individualism, adherence to rigid time schedules, and the belief that hard work is the key to success as traits of the dominant white culture. They teach instead that minority cultures value color group collectivism, interdependence, group success, shared property, and learning through social relationships. And oh, by the way, the story goes on to report that, shockingly, this school does really bad in terms of performance when its students take standardized tests. Jim, I don't even know where to start here.
I was going to say, what was I just saying in that last martini about bad schools and not teaching kids to, you know, the importance of, you know, showing up on time? By the way, as we speak, the president has not shown up for his Obamacare event on time. So maybe timeliness just isn't as important as it used to be in this culture. I'm looking at this, and I would love to see what this question was that to set her off, Greg, because if it was, if I have two peanut butter and jelly sandwiches and you have two peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, how many peanut jelly sandwiches do we have together? Because if at that point, you don't need to, I'd love to know what question you need to know the components of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. You know, if you had said, I have two blah, 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 blahs, and you have two blah, 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 blahs, you know, how many do we have to get? You don't need to know what a blah, blah, blah is, right?
Right.
All you need to know is the number. The only time I can think of a case in which, you know, as you're reading this article, being a suburbanite like myself, Greg, do you know what crown molding is?
Yes.
So it's a thing that goes around the kind of the where the ceiling and the wall meet up at the top of the room, and it goes around.
Yes.
And I remember one time in math class, there was a word problem which we had to calculate how this, you know, the crown molding. And I thought it was some, I thought it was like a tile. I thought it was like something you put across. So instead of doing the periphery, measuring the distance around the room, I measured the acreage of the room.
Mm.
So I can understand in a word problem, if you use a term that the student may not be familiar with, then that can cause a problem or something. I'm really dying to know, like, what is the chemical composition of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich? Like, what was the question that she finds so bothersome? And what it really looks like is that this is a woman who is trying to find problems to explain why, you know, people are doing badly, when in fact what it might be is that, you know, whatever that question was asking about, be it addition, subtraction, or, you know, there's a reading comprehension. I'd really love to know what that problem was, because look, sub in torta or pita, okay? By the way, my experience with the most schools that public schools I've been in is that she says, what about Somali or Hispanic students who might not eat sandwiches? Look, I think Somali Hispanic students are probably doing better than everybody else, okay? At least the Somali ones. They, you know, the immigrant kids generally know they got to work their butts off in order to succeed in school and succeed in life. This is like the distilled essence of everything that's wrong with public education. This woman is looking for excuses instead of trying to figure out a way, all right, how can I get these kids to do better than they can? If you have your kid in Portland public schools, maybe it's time to think about moving.
Yeah, when communism essentially is the answer, shared property, group collectivism.
Wait, why is it a majority culture thing to show up on time?
I don't know.
Really? I mean, really? Really? Other cultures don't have clocks? Other cultures don't? Anyway.
Hard work,
I keep going down this line. So anyway. So America, that was a good martini, a bad martini, and a crazy martini that all lived up to the hype. They all fit their definitions there.
Jim, have a great day.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.